Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll talk with Brian Victoria, professor of Japanese studies at Antioch University. We'll talk about the Fukushima nuclear disaster from a year ago and how the global effect of that event reaches here to Ohio. Jim McCarthy tells us about the National Fair Housing Alliance and their claim that banks are practicing discrimination in their treatment of foreclosed properties in minority neighborhoods. Ellen Belcher has Politics Ohio. Up first, many radio listeners around the world have fond memories of their old college and university radio stations. Some college alum continue to support those stations in a number of ways, and support is something one particular station may be in need of right now. We learned this week that a busted water pipe has caused the student-run radio station at Wittenberg University to temporarily go off the air. WUSO 89.1 FM was knocked off the air over Easter weekend when 4 feet of water flooded the basement of Firestone Hall, home to the radio station and approximately 200 students. WYSO's Wayne Baker spoke to Wittenberg's Dean of Students and Vice President for Enrollment Management, Sarah Kelly, to get the details.
On early Sunday morning, we discovered a major water main break in the basement of Firestein Hall, where WUSO is located, and there was about 4 feet of water in the basement when we discovered it. So we spent all day Sunday through 5 o'clock yesterday restoring services to the hall. We had to take the hall completely offline, and of course, WUSO was part of that.
And how long do you estimate that the station will be off the air?
We don't have any hard dates at this moment. We did file with the FCC the preliminary filing that we will be off the air for at least 10 days, if not longer. The FCC also requires that if we're going to be off the air for more than 30 days, that we petition to keep our license. So we have our attorney working on that.
How much do you estimate the repairs and so forth to be at this point?
We don't have a cost estimate at this point. We did have a sound engineer go in last night and take a look. Basically all the electronic equipment is a total loss. The water did reach the soundboards, so we're looking to have to replace everything.
And how many students did you have there that were working at the station? And also, did you have any full-time employees that are there at this point?
We don't have any full-time employees. WUSO, we're really proud to say, is a student-run organization and radio station, and so it's primarily run with a group of executives, student executives, and then a lot of student volunteers and DJs. So I know that there are 5 executives and then a whole lot of other students who are involved. Our Tiger Sports Network was also broadcast off of WUSO.
Will you try to use any other stations to broadcast or just stay off the air until you can get up and running again?
Again, we're still just trying to recover from the acute phase of all of this. We haven't gotten that far in our planning. I know our goal is to bring it back online as soon as possible.
Well, Sarah, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you giving us the information.
Well, thanks, and I hope in the interim that our listeners will tune in to WYSO.
Sarah Kelly with Wittenberg University, we wish them all the best in getting back on the air. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Last week, the National Fair Housing Alliance and 4 of its member organizations announced they were filing a federal housing discrimination complaint against Wells Fargo Bank. The complaint will be filed with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's the result of an undercover investigation, and the Housing Alliance says major American banks like Wells Fargo are failing to maintain and market real estate-owned properties in African American and Latino neighborhoods. Jim McCarthy is president and CEO with the Miami Valley Fair Housing Center in Dayton, a Fair Housing Alliance member. He confirms the investigation reveals a big discrepancy in the way neighborhoods are treated.
We've been looking at this issue for over 2 years now. We did our first report in April of 2011, and we released the second report last week on April the 3rd, 2012. In the Wells Fargo case, we looked at 100% of the properties in the zip codes that we had identified, and what we found was that 90% of REO properties in African American communities had more than 5 maintenance or marketing deficiencies, when only 57% of REO properties in white communities had more than 5 deficiencies. We looked at things, very basic things, because some of the feedback that we had received from lenders was that in some neighborhoods, it's more difficult to maintain a property because of vandalism. But we looked at just really basic things, like the amount of accumulated mail that had been permitted to pile up at the property. Then we looked at overgrown or dead shrubs, and 70% of REO properties in African American communities had overgrown or dead shrubs, while only 43% of the REO properties in white communities had that problem. So we have a number of different indices that we believe clearly demonstrate a failure by Wells Fargo and company to appropriately maintain their properties.
And so you mentioned a couple of maintenance criteria, but also the claim alleges improprieties in the way these properties were marketed, correct?
That's absolutely true. Just basic things, we looked at, again, whether or not the property was actively being marketed. And what we found is that 90% of the properties in African-American communities did not have a for sale sign on them at all, while only 57% of the REO properties in white communities had the same problem for Wells Fargo properties.
It does lend itself to the idea of discrimination. Is there a thought on the banks that the neighborhoods just aren't worth it regardless of color? Is it the condition they were already in?
Yeah, we're not sure what Wells Fargo's response is going to be. We have heard from some folks in the industry, just exactly as you said, well, we don't know what condition these properties were in when we got them. And that is absolutely true. We have no argument with that. And we certainly do not expect lenders to improve the value of the property. But we do believe that the banks have an obligation, and they have a contractual obligation with their investors, the people who actually own the properties and for which the bank is maintaining the properties and attempting to resell it, to number one, secure the property or secure the asset that's represented by the property. So if there are broken windows, at a minimum, those windows should be boarded so that people cannot go in and out and strip the house. And then they have an obligation to the neighborhood to do basic things like cut the grass, cut the bushes, and remove trash so that they don't bring down the overall neighborhood during dependency and holding of the property in the REO stasis. So we're not talking about whether or not a bank should go in and do renovations to improve the house that's there. But if the bank believes that the property is so far gone so that it is not salvageable and it's not worth anything, then we believe that the bank has an obligation to demolish the property and actually clear the property so that it doesn't become a nuisance on the city and on the neighborhood.
Is there any statistics on that, how many properties are being demolished in neighborhoods of color?
I do know from the work that we do that the city of Dayton, which is where the majority of our minority communities are concentrated, did allocate more than 60% of their neighborhood stabilization program money, or NSP money, toward demolition because of the number of vacant and abandoned properties that they have in the city. But I don't have any good statistics on what private lenders are doing.
And just a final question for you. What neighborhoods in Dayton did you look at?
Well, we really looked at census tracts, census block group, and so they were scattered throughout, and we looked at neighborhoods. We classified them as black neighborhoods if the racial composition, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, was 50% or greater. And we classified neighborhoods as white, again, if the racial composition was 50% or greater white. And we looked at comparisons, and we did try to make an attempt to look at similarly priced homes. So we were not comparing a $50,000 home against a $350,000 home, but we did control for that, and we were looking at similarly valued homes.
Okay. And so what you found in Dayton matches the other cities that were investigated?
Yes, that's correct. It's Washington, D.C., metropolitan area, Baltimore, Maryland, Philadelphia, Oakland and Richmond, Concord, California, Dayton, Miami, Florida, Dallas, Texas, and Atlanta, Georgia.
So, Jim, what are you guys expecting out of this lawsuit? What do you want to hear back?
Well, Specifically, we hope to enter into a dialogue with Wells Fargo, and we want to see the communities of color that have been harmed by the failure to maintain and market these REOs made whole. We want to move forward with the HUD investigation, and hopefully we can achieve some concrete solutions to these serious civil rights violations that have been raised in our complaint.
So Wells Fargo is the only bank mentioned so far in the claim, correct?
Yes, they're the only one mentioned in the complaint that is being filed today, but there are subsequent complaints that are going to be coming. We're planning to file another complaint next Tuesday. This is Fair Housing Month, and so we have timed our investigation and the filing of our complaints to roll out during Fair Housing Month to point up the need that we have throughout the country.
Jim McCarthy, President and CEO with Miami Valley Fair Housing Center in Dayton. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. It's been just over a year since multiple disasters in Japan, including an earthquake and tsunami, critically jeopardized Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant. The event has far-reaching implications for the planet. On April 21st, Antioch University Midwest will hold a public forum to look at what really happened at Fukushima. Is the danger really over? And how will the disaster affect the nuclear power generation in the United States? To talk about the upcoming forum, our guest is Brian Victoria, professor of Japanese studies at Antioch University. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Jerry.
Brian, you've led Antioch Education Abroad's Japan and its Buddhist Traditions program since 2005. You've written several books on Zen and the Japanese language. Let's talk briefly about your background in Japanese studies.
Well, my focus is on religion and violence. I came to this field by looking at the role of Buddhism, particularly Zen Buddhism, within Japanese militarism during World War II. So that's where my field of expertise lies.
Before we talk about the forum, can you recap what happened last year in Japan?
Well, I wish I could. I mean, we know some things, but there's still a lot we don't know, Jerry. For certain, we know that there was a large earthquake, which then sparked a tsunami or a tidal wave, and that inundated the plant. And there's even debate as to whether the plant was melting down before the tidal wave hit. We have to remember that in this case, there was a 45-minute gap between the time of the earthquake and the actual time of the tidal wave. So there's good evidence to suggest that, in fact, the reactors, in this case, three reactors, 1, 2, and 3, at Fukushima Daiichi meaning number one, at the number one plant, that all three reactors were actually melting down even before they were struck by the tsunami. Once the tsunami hit, why, then the backup electrical power plant, that was wiped out. And as a result, there was no coolant for the three reactors, well, for any of the reactors. And they then proceeded to melt down. And once they had melted down, there was, it appears, and we don't know this for sure yet, but it appears there was a hydrogen buildup inside the containment buildings. And then the three buildings exploded. And with the explosion, this also released a massive amount of radiation. And I'm sad to say that radiation is continuing to this day, except that they have been able to get electrical power restored, and they are keeping the nuclear fuel cooled to some degree with water that it's circulating. But the trouble with the water, of course, is that it becomes irradiated. And now they have to store the irradiated water where they were first putting it back into the ocean, and that just continues to build up on the site. We think of disasters, and we think of them as a disaster happens, a tidal wave happens, and everything is in the past. But this is really a disaster that is ongoing to the present day.
And also it's a disaster that has large implications for future damage on a global scale as well.
It certainly does, because the Fukushima Daiichi reactors are still in a precarious situation. Not the reactors themselves. No one has been able to look into to see what's going on in reactors number 1 and 3. They've looked into reactor number 2, and they found the radiation was so high there that if a human being were to enter that containment building, they would die within 10 minutes. And they can't even send robots in because the robot electronics would also melt down. because of the radiation. And so we've got a situation, Jerry, where at Fukushima, where it is beyond human understanding as to how to proceed. And that is leaving out that we don't know what's really going on in reactors number 1 and 3. We talk about a meltdown, and that's for sure. But it may also mean there was a melt through, and that the nuclear material is on the floor, or even possibly, as we speak, eating through the concrete. When that nuclear fuel does that and gets far enough down into the ground and meets the groundwater, there could at any time, Jerry, be another major explosion or explosions spewing more radioactivity into the air. And that's even the good news, Jerry. The bad news is that there are spent fuel pools, especially in reactors number 3 and 4. And what's strange about 4 is that was shut down at the time. Reactor 4 was actually shut down. But they had taken the fresh shut down for servicing. But they had taken the fresh fuel from number 4 and put it in the spent fuel pool, which is 100 feet above ground. And now with the explosions, that those spent fuel pools, both in reactors 3 and 4, are now exposed to the air. The building is in very bad shape, and it's widely predicted if there were to be another large, a massive earthquake, those spent fuel pools could collapse. If they did that, the fuel rods would be exposed to the air, would burn, perhaps explode, another massive release of radiation that could be, it's predicted, as much as 200 times the radioactivity released by Chernobyl. So we can see if the worst case scenario could still happen. And in fact, worldwide seismologists have told us that there is, over the next 4 years, I've heard anything from a 75% chance to a 98% chance of another magnitude 7 or above massive earthquake. So the point is, Jerry, we're still far, far from resolving this issue, and it literally could still blow up in our faces, but more importantly, it could blow up in our air, and it could release massive amounts of radiation even now.
As we've talked about, this is a global problem. Is it being dealt with by a global community, or is Japan handling this themselves? And by handling, I mean as much as can be done.
As can be done, as much as humans understand what to do. I hate to give so many dire warnings or information, but the reality is that we still don't have, there is an Atomic Energy Commission, but their real responsibility, at least initially, was to promote nuclear energy use in the world. To answer your question, at the moment, Japan is still trying to do it on its own. And in fact, two Japanese former ambassadors have now come out publicly and said that Japan, given its track record, given the government's systematic lies, and given the TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company's lies about what has really been going on, that neither the Japanese government nor TEPCO can be trusted with this situation, that they have appealed for the people of throughout the world to put pressure on the Japanese government to bring in outside experts who are truly independent, who have the expertise, probably to shore up these spent fuel pools, the buildings in the first instance, but also to recommend how to proceed because we are in uncharted waters. So these are two former Japanese diplomats, ambassadors, who are appealing to the world to put pressure on their own government to bring in outside experts. And I certainly support their efforts.
So let's talk about the day-long public forum at Antioch University Midwest in Yellow Springs on Saturday the 21st. It starts at 10:15 a.m. It coincides with Earth Day. Let's talk about what's going to take place there.
All right. Well, we're going to start off in the morning with a recap. There's a wonderful BBC documentary called A is for Atom. And what it does is it goes back and tells us how we all are aware, of course, of the way the atomic age began with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we're going to take a look at that documentary, and then we're going to have a discussion about it. And then following that, we're going to have a light lunch free of charge. And then after that, I will be speaking on something called the U.S. Responsibility for Fukushima. All of those reactors that melted down at Fukushima were made in the USA. The American government and GE's responsibility for what eventually happened at Fukushima. Following that, we have a guest coming in. His name is Kevin Kamps, and he is from an organization called Beyond Nuclear. He was in Fukushima actually before. He warned that this was going to happen.
Brian, let me just ask you to reiterate why what happened is important to people here in Ohio and how this forum can help them process all the information.
First of all, because we don't yet really know what happened at Fukushima or Fukushima Daiichi. And what does that mean? It means that if we don't know what really happened, how can we prevent it from happening in the future? And why is that so important? Because as we speak, we are currently already, for the first time in some 35 years, we're actually actively building nuclear power plants in the United States, in that area, in both South Carolina and Georgia. How can we be certain that if we don't know what really happened at Fukushima, that it won't happen with these new plants? But more important, we have 23 Mark I GE reactors, the identical design, that have been identified as being very dangerous as early as 1972. And those reactors are still in operation, particularly at Vermont Yankee has now been the center of attention. And we're going to be asking Mark Shanahan, who's the former energy advisor to governor in the Strickland administration, to talk to us about nuclear power in Ohio. What is its history, what's going on now, and what the outlook is for the future, and despite or even after what's happened at Fukushima. We're going to try and sort all of this out and figure out where do we go from here. So the forum again starts at 10:15 in the morning, and if you can take it, and we hope many people will because of its importance, it will go through until 5:30 in the afternoon.
Brian, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I look forward to seeing as many folks as possible at our forum.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. I'm talking with State Representative Teresa Fetter, a Democrat from Toledo, and the force behind a new law and pending legislation aimed at punishing human trafficking. Thanks for your time, Representative Fetter.
Thank you.
A lot of people can't get their head around the fact that there's a so-called slave trade going on in this country. They can't really imagine anyone holding another person against her will in the 21st century and actually getting by with it. What exactly are these hidden crimes that you've been focusing on?
Human trafficking has been defined as commercial exploitation of people. Trafficking is the fastest growing international crime, second only to drug dealing. And in 2000, Congress passed the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, making human trafficking a federal crime and defining two categories, labor and sex. The question has often been, is there human trafficking in Ohio? The answer to that question is yes. It is slavery, pure and simple, and I believe it is the human rights issue of our time. Human trafficking rings exist, and more people are being pushed into it, including our children. So we absolutely must stop the prostitution of our children, number one, and imprison those who exploit, use, and profit from human slavery. In Ohio, we have been focusing, or I have been focusing on this problem for 7 years. So it's taken us a while.
Some human trafficking research says that the average age of girls who are forced into prostitution is 13. How does a girl that young just disappear? How is she forced into participating in crimes without her family's knowledge?
The whole way to sum this up is to think about how vulnerable our children are and when are they most vulnerable. There's a lot going on involving families in crisis that makes our children even more vulnerable. And people who want to exploit human beings know this. And it starts off by complimenting them. If there's a girl that has a low self-esteem, if a trafficker comes along and says, I think you're pretty, and she'll say, oh, really? And then all of a sudden, gives her a lot of attention. He knows she's vulnerable. there's money involved. He takes care of her. He's the only person that's ever really loved her. And they're easily entrapped. Before you know it, they're being turned out into prostitution. And I often explain to people that prostitution is not the oldest profession in the world. It's the oldest oppression in the world, and we must come from that perspective to clean this up. My goal is to absolutely rescue the victims and focus on providing services for the recovery and a big focus on strengthening our laws to break the back of this crime.
You've introduced legislation that you call Safe Harbor for Exploited Children. There's been some pushback from some legislators and prosecutors who aren't ready to sign on. Explain the changes in the law that you and others helped usher in last year and what you think still needs to be fixed.
My goal, number one, is to rescue the victims and provide services. And oftentimes we find them through law enforcement. And we need that. We need law enforcement to be educated, advocating the recovery of these victims. And that's not been the case. They've often saw them as criminals because that's what our criminal code does, even if they're minors. Working with law enforcement, judges, the advocates, this is not a very easy thing to do.
I know Ohio has a human trafficking commission, and yes, one of its priorities is educating law enforcement about this issue. What should police be looking for, and what have been some of law enforcement's mistakes, if you will, in dealing with this crime?
Originally, the legislation I had 2 General Assemblies ago required mandatory training for law enforcement. This was not welcomed. Prosecutors didn't think we had a problem with human trafficking. We didn't need to change our laws. So there was a lot of educating and advocating and work by the Lucas County FBI Task Force that helps us focus on what's important and what needs to be done. They have been seeing victims of trafficking, but they didn't know it.
I've been talking with State Representative Teresa Fetter, who wants Ohio to adopt tougher laws to prevent forced prostitution and human trafficking. Thanks for talking with me, Representative Fetter.
Thank you.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of middle spring. The great dandelion bloom is the most common and the most radical marker for the third week of middle spring. Of course, a few dandelions started blooming in February and March. Now, however, comes the great dandelion flower that begins in the deep south, where middle spring comes much earlier than it does in the north, and spreads up through the border state like robins, reaching the 40th parallel of the lateral midline of the United States in April, and then creeps up to the northern states in May. Whenever it reaches you, the great dandelion flowering turns lawns and waysides golden with their blossoms and announces the greening of the high trees, the maples, the oaks, mulberries, locusts, and ginkgos, sending out their first leaves. It trumpets tulip season and the budding of peonies in the garden. The great dandelion bloom in the alleys and along the freeways lets you know that if you had time to take to the woods, you could find hepatica, periwinkle, toad trillium, cowslip, rue anemone, and buttercups in flower. In the vegetable garden, you might find fresh asparagus, new herbs for seasoning, maybe lettuce leaves long enough for salad. And above golden fields of dandelion flowers, the more exotic yet no less powerful marker of the third week of middle spring, all the fruit trees coming in. First, the pears put out their white blossoms, then the pink peaches and the cherries, and then the roseate and white and red crab apples. Like the seeds of dandelions, the pears and peaches and apples reveal the season from New Orleans to Maine and Minneapolis, telling time far better and more beautifully than any paper or digital calendar. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of middle spring. In the meantime, watch the dandelions and the fruit trees all come into bloom all across the country.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. Coming up tonight on the Sunday Documentary Hour, a final installment of Person, Place, Thing. Here's Sarah Buckingham.
Tonight, the short-run series Person, Place, Thing wraps up with two final interviews. Host Randy Cohen talks with athlete Roger Bannister, who describes running the very first four-minute mile. And columnist and gay rights advocate Dan Savage offers an intriguing revisionist history of the Tudor dynasty. He also tells us about why one specific front porch in Illinois means so much to him. That's tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the final episode of Person, Place, Thing.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all of our guests, and thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, The Book Nook.